So,
you want to dedicate the shiur, nakdisha da shiur hazeh, dedicate the shiur to civility and machloket l'shem shemayim. That if people have disagreements, it should be for the sake of heaven. And that every time we get together in the Beit Midrash and we study Talmud, it exemplifies some intense debates. There were sides and houses, and Hillel won out because they would both teach the other side's argumentation first, then their own, and they would permit women from their own house to marry women of Beit Shammai. Right? So that's Jewish culture that's so needed today in our world. So please God, may we see it come true, and may our Gemara learning inspire us and others around us to really take that challenge. And if our first inclination after hearing that is to blame someone, that we should take a cheshbon and nefesh, that we should really take an accounting of ourselves. If immediately upon hearing such a dedication that I could point the finger and blame, the Baal Shem Tov said, first take an accounting three times. There are three fingers pointing back your way. So this is a big Torah that he taught his Hasidim, and I so deeply want to believe that every small stitch of goodness that we put in the world through our learning is really making a difference. It really is. So Tani, we are going to continue in the Gemara. We left off the last time with the question, what are we really going to say does God have power over? The philosophical point of where we are in Tani. You could say, began already with the question, how can you ask when you start saying something if you don't ask why? You know, when do we say this extra line of ritual, of liturgy, to recognize that God's the bringer of the wind and the rain? And we talk about the time of the year, and but really the question of the Gemara, in the opener, if you will, is why are you starting with the question when? You start saying something, some line of liturgy, when we should be talking about the why we say this. And the why gets into the whole subject of what it is that Kodesh Baruch Hu, that God really does have power over. And how God's power in the world coexists with human power in the world. What does God control? What do we control? What do we think God controls and is going to be consistent, and it's going to behave in a consistent kind of a way? What do we think is at all potentially tectonic and shifting, and like the plates, the tectonic plates, and what do we think is really going to shift, and how do we start noticing that? What is it that we take control of, or could a little bit have some agency over? And we saw, and what we're building on, is the notion that God had three keys, right? On page 2A3, on the right-hand side, because Rabbi Yochanan says, and remember that we're in this Gemara talking about liturgy, but we're now going to get into this why. God has power. That's why we're saying our prayers at all. We're recognizing God's power. And God has three keys in the hand of the Holy One. Shalonim saru biyad shaliach, that we're not entrusted to an agent, even though human beings seem to have agency with some of these things. But God really is the one in control of all these things, and they are the key of rain, the key of childbirth, and the key of the revival of the dead. Mafteach shel gishamim, mafteach shel chaya, which really is the word not only for childbirth, but when I say chaya, right, I hear chai, I hear life. Which is not only the power of reviving the dead, it's really death. So I've got it all. I've got the natural world when it comes to Geshem, because without Geshem, I wouldn't have any natural world. I wouldn't really be able to live.
despite even having a planet, a rock that stands and is supported in the midst of the great universe of space, I need Geshem. Geshem is what we saw in the Midrash, if you remember, Midrash Rabbah, that said, with water and land, then can come human beingness. And that's, each of those is judged, the land, the rain, and human beings. And so I have in these symbols, though, of the keys in God's hand, three different areas, and that is the symbol of the natural world and potentially natural law. I have life, and that is this world, Olam Hazeh. And in the resurrection of the dead, I have God who's also the master of what? All time. I have Olam Haba. And so I really get the full sense of the why coming into focus. But the question we're going to start with, which I asked you to think about, if you were a liturgist and you were on that committee who was really creating the liturgy of what it is we are going to recognize God having power over beyond the wind and the rain, or beyond the three areas that Rabbi Yochanan talked about, which are rain, childbirth, life, resurrection of the dead, Tichyat HaMetim, what would you include? And in the Gemara, that question comes to life by a short passage where they propose yet another aspect of life that God has control over. Or maybe not so much. In other words, just simply by proposing it, and I've presented this way of reading Gemara before in the Beit Midrash, by the rabbis proposing some either addition or alternative, or even the notion of just breaking open the discussion with, let me propose this, this opens the floodgates for us as readers to think about what is it that we think is really in God's control. What should the liturgy say? Or what should that midrash have said? What do we want to ask Rabbi Yochanan to include when he says, these are the keys on the ring of God? So the Gemara is going to propose one other aspect, but we're going to see that as the open door, as the possibility, as the pitchon peh, as we say in the literary way, in our tradition. It's the pitchon peh. It's an opening for us to express our ideas. And that is on 2b1. So now turn to 2b1 with me, and that's where we're going to start this evening, about that possibility that exists beyond those keys on the ring. And it's on the left-hand side, where it says, the Gemara continues with a similar teaching. Bimarava Amre, in the west, which is the land of Israel, and I've remarked before that sometimes that's the open door for what? A criticism of what's going on in the west, an argument with somebody who doesn't really have it all together in Israel, a criticism like really an insult, which we studied one summer. But here, it's simply brought as a reality that we recognize that the Jewish world is beyond us, and that there is midrash, there is a limud in this regard, there is an Eretz Yisrael where people have thought like we do of our God and the powers that God has. And what do they teach in the West? They say, Af Mafteach Shel Parnassah. So when I'm talking about God's key ring, I not only talk about the three keys that God has, I also talk about Parnassah. Income. Making a living. That which God provides in order for us to sustain our lives. Now, mind you, what might we have expected as the fourth possibility if we were given the opportunity? Someone, you know, how you get those key rings open sometimes. You know, that's why we love the new ones that you unscrew or your carabiners that you press. You know, those key rings, it's a grounded metaphor, right? Everybody's had this experience, or is it just me? How do you get those rings open? But someone's pried open the ring, and they said, let me add a fourth key. So the key that's added in the West is Parnassah. It's a livelihood. It's how to make a living. It's how to get your portion. It's how to be in the world. If I said to you simply, what is your fourth key? Right. The committee is the Beit Midrash. Rabbi Yochanan teaches, and someone says in the Beit Midrash, well, in the Marava I hear it's four keys, and the fourth key is Parnassa. That's where we left off last week, so I'm teeing up the question again. Anybody think of the first thing they might say that would give us the same philosophical outlook? Food. That's the one that I was just thinking of, the word mazon. I think mazon and food is subsumed within Parnassa. I think. I want to make that argument. Because water and life and death, right? I need something more than water. And water is there to create from earth the possibility to at least eat, right? I want to say that it's mazon, yeah?
Don't you think that food is what makes Geshem so important, that it's included?
It might.
Geshem?
That's the other side of it. So I'm with you too. But on the other hand, maybe Geshem is Gashmiut. That's where I'm going with this. Right? That's the material world. That's the world of physical sustenance that comes out of the water sustenance, right? And so Geshem and Gashmiut, and Gashmiut doesn't have to be gaudy material stuff of the 20th century. It can be the real material stuff we need to live. The Hasidim in the 19th century started to really contrast the olam of Gashmiut to the olam of Ruchaniut, the world of materiality to the world of spirituality. And that you had to sanctify, and you could sanctify, and you could redeem sparks from the world, from the material world. That was a doctrine that Louis Jacobs talks about in one of the seminal articles about the whole theological outlook of Hasidut. But we are talking about potentially that mazon as part of Geshem, or I thought maybe mazon in and of itself should be a fourth. Anybody with a different fourth?
Happiness.
Yeah, maybe there is a certain beyond life and death in the middle. You really need something.
You can have everything and you could be not happy, so there is no value to life.
Exactly. So I thought also of the lines from the wedding blessings. Ista, chedva, achva, ahava, all those kind of words can be summed up in some way with simcha, right? And it's not just happiness as in the emotive happy smile, it's samech b'chelko, it's your chelek, it's your portion. But maybe Parnassa also
this is, one aspect.
Is in that way kind of, it, you know, contains that, but it's not wide enough, I don't think. So maybe we do need simcha.
I'm just disagreeing with the previous two suggestions, forgive me. But only because it says three kings, three rings. HaKadosh Baruch Hu,
three keys.
What?
Three keys.
Three keys, I'm sorry. That he didn't put in the hand of an intermediary, the messenger, Shalich. And these things we're talking about, I think the role of human beings in those things is so powerful, or we want it to be. I see these three things as being very different.
Great.
Right? Because the gift of life, you could argue that people can heal. But I think happiness and things like that, and the production of food is meant to be a human endeavor. I mean, from
great.
From the beginning.
So great read. Because that's now,
that
expands us back to the read. The important part of his limud is not just the aspects that I'm making such a big notion of, but it's that they weren't given to the hands of shlichim. What do you have agency over, and what do you not? But the interesting thing, given what we have said thus far, which is why I will agree that some of those might even make more sense if I was asking about what the three original ones should be, is that it seems to me that there are other aspects of life that I have very little control over. And that argument now that's being made is that with Parnassa, that you thought you had agency over it, but maybe you don't have so much agency over it. So given that expansion, A, do you agree that Parnassa fits the list, and B, is there a better fourth? Right?
I'll suggest two. Building on what you said about the physical world and the spiritual world, emunah is often in the hands of God. I think you can argue whether it's in the hands of God or in our own hands, but I think it's we do pray to God to bring us back to Him. So there's something there.
It's interesting. Okay, let me remember that so I know. Register my Gemara. There's a Gemara that came to mind as you said that. Okay, keep going.
And the other one is health. And there again, right. Our generation in particular has come to believe that we have agency in whether we're healthy or not, and to some extent we do, but ultimately we don't control our own health.
Good. So, to me, I debated whether or not the fourth, given everything that the Limud contains, that it's really not in the hand of a shliach. Reality check. We do have doctors. We have said, always go to a doctor. We have the commandment, Rapo Yirape, you shall surely heal. You shall surely endeavor to do this, but in the end, we seem to not know everything we need to know yet to get every tikkun, every fix that we need, every prescription we need in order to heal everyone. These, in some ways, though, provide the greatest challenge. Now, let's go to faith. Not sure that we can come up with a working definition of faith that would satisfy everyone if I just have the word faith there. If I said we're talking about a faith that there's something beyond humanity and there's a either, you know, in Greek philosophical terms, a prime cause. Or I say in theological terms, God exists and God is beyond. So therefore God is neither moral or immoral, right? God is amoral. And I say that is the ultimate truth of the universe.
But in this context,
yeah,
it would be a faith that there is a God who has agency over me.
Yes, that has some, you know, determination of our lives. Whether it's more like a watch winder,
well,
a watchmaker, or even a chessmate or a chess player.
I would say in this context, it would not be a watchmaker because the assumption is that we can pray and change what happens.
Okay, then prayer.
I'm trying to stay within the...
Yeah, and then prayer plays a large role. The Gemara that came to mind when you said that at first was the Gemara that said, Hakol b'yidei shamayim, everything's in the hands of heaven. Chutz miyirat shamayim. Except for your fear or your awe of God. So everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear or awe of heaven. Right? So these are about whether or not, right, God is really there somewhere between the watchmaker for natural law and a chess player, as I think about God, really, we call this hashgacha, right? That God has a real intent and may through intent create what the reality is as it unfolds each minute. Maybe that is what needed to be taught, but that creates some amount of, let's say, consternation because we know the rabbis have all kinds of doctrines of free will and where free will really comes into play. Right? So that if I really thought that God's consistent moving the pieces on the board was the way that the world worked, it wouldn't jive with the free will doctrines that are all over the Mishnah and the Gemara. So, to push it forward, we really are talking about, in the Gemara, because there's that debate that was introduced already, that we saw last time, wait a minute, But even the even that which you have said God holds the keys to, there is some human agency. You've actually shared with humans the power to over some of these. And remember, we read the Tosafot that said, well, God didn't permanently put the keys on anybody else's ring. That God may empower us at a certain moment in order to achieve that. That was the Tosafot on the first, on the last narrow line, the first wide line, remember. Shlosha matechot shelo nimsaru l'shaliach, the three keys that were not given to an agent, v'item v'hamrina, but if you say and challenge this and say, you know, d'mafteach ha'gishamim nimsarin le'eliyahu, that Eliyahu had controls over reigns, as in the chapters in Kings 17 and then the beginning of 18, v'chein mafteach shel tichyat ha'metim, and so too with any kind of revival of the dead that we find in that chapter, v'chein le'elisha, and also to other prophets, then we get to the end of that Tosafot, shelo nimsaru me'olam. In other words, God didn't give them permanently to anyone. But God may provide you some power to even have agency or an impact or influence with these very incredible powers that exist in the world. So, I want to hand this to you as a little bit of what we want to look at outside of the Gemara in a minute, but finish this piece of text first to see, you know, kind of where does that go? Where does it go that when they say a parnasa is also one of these keys that God maintains control over and only gives to a shaliach now and then, right? Because that's what we have to think about when we say, well, maybe parnasa is one of those keys. What is the verse that proves that the key of sustenance, the key of making a living, is also entrusted to God, or that it's part of God's powers? Poteach et yadecha, you, God, open your hand. And what is the next part of that pasuk? Umasbia l'chol chai ratzon, and you satisfy all living creatures. Therefore, mazon, back to food, is inherently part of the verse now that was brought forward to prove this point. I can include mazon in a intertextual kind of way now, right? I've quoted a verse that actually includes not only does God open the hand and give what's necessary, but it actually goes even further and makes the point, umasbia l'chol chai ratzon, and it satisfies and uses the term masbia, which is the root sin bet ayin, which is the same word that's used in Deuteronomy, v'achalta v'savata uverachta, you ate, you were satisfied, and that's when I know you bless, right? The savata umasbia. There's that language connection that makes for the connection to food. But Rabbi Yochanan, the Gemara asks, Rabbi Yochanan, my tamalo ka chashiv laha. Why did he not list this one then, Rabbi Yochanan, in that first limud that he taught? Why didn't he say Parnassa was really part of it? Amar lach, Rabbi Yochanan can answer you. Gishamim hainu parnasa. The key of rain is the same as the rain of sustenance. And there you go. Inside, we, in discussing just the suggestion of it all, came up with the answers that the Gemara has. To push forward before we get to the chapter, go to page 2b2, because right now they're going to do a little bit of inside work as to which verses prove all the parts that God has these powers. And I want to bring you to the second column on page 2b2 on the right, where the Gemara is going to answer, Amar lach Rabbi Yoshua, Bishlama tichyat ha'metim mazkir, on 2b. Here, I'll get my...
be like, Havok Ishami Bechak, is that right?
No, the bottom, Shapir. Let's take a look where it says Shapir on the bottom of 11, last little paragraph on 11 there. Okay, so it says Shapir Kamarle, and where the, it says the Gemara comments, for those on 2b2 in the Schottenstein. Shapir Kamarle Rabbi Eliezer le Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Eliezer replied well to Rabbi Yoshua. It should be permitted to mention rain even at times that are inappropriate for rain. Just as the resurrection of the dead is mentioned in our prayers all year round, even though its time has not yet arrived. Right? So we have this, this is another one of the arguments that we've seen before. In other words, you told me I had to start saying the powers of rain and wind at a certain point, and that was going to be now either the beginning of Sukkot or Shemini Atzeret. But you told me also that we've mentioned the powers of resurrection of the dead all year. Why shouldn't we mention God's powers to bring the rain and the wind if all we're talking about really is God's powers and we're not really asking for the rain, right? Because remember the problem, we didn't want the rain on Sukkot. So what's Rabbi Yeshua's response to that argument? The Gemara answers, Amar lach, Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua can answer you, Bishlama tichyat ha-metim mazkir. It's understandable why one mentions the resurrection of the dead throughout the year. It's very straightforward. Why? The Chuleyayim Azim Nahu. Any day could be the resurrection of the dead. Any day God wants it. There's no season for the resurrection of the dead. This is season for rain. We don't really know.
If God holds the power of rain, he can do it any day too.
Yes, so that's the... I want you to keep that question in mind. Why don't we say that? Right? Because what we mean to say in the, again, this gets back to the philosophical sense of the maftachot that God holds, the keys that God holds, If I say God holds the key to the reins, what I really am saying in a larger, expansive way is that God holds the keys to the natural order.
To the calendar.
To the calendar and to the natural order, to the natural laws that every day are renewed. B'chol yom u'mechadesh, or every day God renews the Maaseh Bereishit, the works of creation. So when I say Geshamim here in this limud, when I hear Rabbi Yochanan say that, I don't think just rains and food then. I can expand it and say, the power of the way the world works, natural law.
They would not have seen it as breaking natural law if the rain starts 2 weeks later or 2 weeks earlier. In other words, we have a concept that...
We're not able to calculate exact days. And as a matter of fact, we know that it could come earlier or later. And they make meaning of that earlier or later. If it starts raining during Sukkot, they think it's a curse because they've done something wrong. Right? They'll even attach it to punishment sin theology.
But that's what I'm saying, is that they're not seeing the natural laws being absolutely predictive of what's
right.
Going to
well, there's no absolutes. We say Bederech Klal, though. You're standing under a cliff. Generally, that cliff is not going to fall. You hope. They know from earthquakes. They know from disasters, but they're feeling very blessed that, in general, today the Palisade stands, so it stands. I think that's really the point of the acceptance of the godly power here. Anyway, so he says, Eila Gishamim, but with respect to rain, Kol Eimat De'atyan Zimnaihu Hi, can it be said that whenever it falls, that it's in its appropriate time? V'hatanan, and this is the exact answer that the Gemara provides. We've learned in the Mishnah, Yatzan Nisan V'yardu Gishamim, if rain fell after the month of Nisan has ended, right, I'm worried. My stalks of barley are there. My stalks of wheat are growing. I don't want there to be, I don't want to get soaked out. So what do we say? Siman Klalahem. That it's a sign of a curse. As it said, Halo Ketzir Chitim Hayom. Is it not the wheat harvest today? And I'll call Hashem, and he'll send thunder and rain that you may know and see that your wickedness is great, So they're going to liken this to Klala because of their wickedness and their sin, and that they're getting rained on in the wrong time because of their sin. So that's one way to look at it, sin and punishment theology. The other is to simply say, stop, take away that verse, Simon Klalahem, that it's kind of a curse to have things happen at their non-natural times. Not just ligabe, not just in regard to my losing my crop because of my sin, but in general that the world seems to be going amok, and that we don't know exactly if that means God's angry. We don't know if that means we sin. We don't know what's going on. You know, it could be as much of a mystery as it is the punishment, sin punishment theology that's around in this limud. So, with this, the question is, where is our agency? So after that discussion originally of what's in Rabbi Yochanan's, and whether or not the fourth makes sense with Parnassa, and other potentials are there, and now we see here that we say this all year, because we recognize it could be any day, but this one we want, and we hope natural law will stay on course, right? That's how I see this this paragraph. Really saying, like, some things could be any time, and we accept that with God, and some things we really hope God put into the world in a certain matter of speaking that are routine and exact enough that we don't notice any kind of hiccup in the fabric of creation, no quote-unquote earthquake that can disturb our presence on the earth. We have this notion that Parnassa, that we're doing everything we can, but we, through hearing that argument, say maybe God does have a say, though, in terms of how we're going to get along in the world, and we want to give ourselves over to that. So then, is the liturgy, back to the reality of our expression of this recognition, is the liturgy expressive enough of what we feel is in God's hands? And also, to ask the question, because you know the rabbis are having this discussion, but they're imagining we're all familiar with the liturgy that we're saying on a daily basis, because the Amidah is ha-tefillah. The Amidah is the central prayer. Is the liturgy expressive enough of our recognition of God's power, and is it expressive enough of our potential agency in the world to make a difference, maybe even in the powers that we're mentioning God has in this passage?
Do you think it's a matter of Chazal wanting to make the point that Parnassa is in the hands of God to express God's power, or is it to sort of cut us down to size and not have people be too impressed with themselves when they do well, and to encourage the kind of sharing that we know is more central feature of their community than it is nowadays?
I really like that Musar read. I think that's a Musar read. In other words, when the Musar movement started reading the Gemara, they would talk about the values of humility being tucked into passages just like this one. Let's add Parnassa, because I know that the wealthy Macher and the poor tzadkan here over here, who's, they call him a tzadkan, even he's accepting tzedakah and he's giving his little bit of tzedakah, that everybody has to be humble. So I think that's a more, as material wealth starts to amass. There, you know, we know that Munbaz has a treasury of gold. We know that there are stories of people who have it, really have enough. But I don't know that it's about putting into check this kind of potential hubris that grows out of doing well, to be true to the text. But I like the limud. I like the musarit. So back to my question. Is it enough what we say, Mashiva Ruach HaMurid HaGashem, with now the hypertext that God has these three keys, and we have some agency within some of that? You know, Barry, we once talked about how dangerous childbirth really was. Right? Is that why this is on this list?
Oh, for sure.
I think so, right?
Well, it's also the brief. I mean, if you don't...
multiply.
If, right, I mean, you're not going to have multiply if you don't have successful pregnancies and deliveries.
I don't want to put you on the spot. When did we start to have any real agency in childbirth? I mean, midwives knew more than we even understand they knew in the ancient world, but do we have any sense of when it got really safer for women, if you will, when childbirth got safer?
When science came in, when the germ theory, you know, if you go back to Semmelweis in Austria, even in the 19th century, there's this horrible classic story about puerperal fever. Many women died after childbirth from infection. And there, they died because the infection, they would do autopsies in the morning on the patients who died the day before, and then go up and examine their patients on the wards. So we know how, before germ theory, and in the late 19th century with Pasteur really the beginning of it, and then Lister with antisepsis, the beginning of antisepsis. Now, you can make the argument that you were better off in, you know, in tribes of 75 or 100, because then you didn't have the possibility of spreading infection from one person to another. We weren't the density really until the agricultural revolution, and that's 10,000 years ago. So agriculture allowed larger numbers of people to live close together, and that, and the other big piece was the domestication of animals, because the animals then became reservoirs for the transmission of germs. They move from animals to humans. So there are a lot of dynamics here. I'm sure midwifery was very quickly one of the most important things in prehistoric times. Exactly how they practiced it, I think, isn't so clear, but it is clear we've gone through a number of what the population geneticists would call bottlenecks, where especially the European population, and of course the Ashkenazi population, in the most dramatic way, and that's why there's such genetic relatedness among Ashkenazi, because of these bottlenecks where only a few people may have survived, and then they expanded back out. But there's no question that childbirth, and you know, I always point that if you go to the Metropolitan, in the section you walk through when you're walking to the back, and I don't know if they're still there, but they had all of the amulets that were given to new brides, and a lot of them had to do with not bleeding to death at childbirth.
Yeah.
And if you take a look, even today, fortunately, we're actually making dramatic improvements in the developing world, but maternal mortality in the developing world, up through the last couple of decades, has been super dramatically higher than it is in countries where modern sanitation is involved. Whether you need a sterile hospital bed or whether it's better to be done at home with good midwives, this is now, this is sort of an ongoing discussion of where's the optimal place for delivery and the safest place. And you can make arguments that hospitals aren't such great places to be in if you don't have to be in them. So I think that's still an ongoing debate. But there's no question that the introduction of antisepsis and the better control over bleeding. Big thing was the introduction of Pitocin to get the uterine, because much of postpartum hemorrhage was failure of the uterus to contract after childbirth. And then routinely women were given a hormone to cause the contraction in order to stem the bleeding, because the contraction actually closes off the blood supply. So infection and bleeding were overwhelmingly the major.
Great. So the age of science, if you will, really then creates somewhat, I'll say it in general terms, less of a mystery about what it is one might suffer through, and one has to depend on only God for, in terms of the power that exists in the world. And so we are provided some of that agency. The agency that we see in the Tanakh, which again we'll get to in a minute, is not a matter of any kind of demonstration of safer midwifery, except to say that when Pharaoh saw how the midwives in the ancient world worked, from whom we could take some great strength, right, that they worked intensely, and who knows what practices they had to create more of a people than they expected could be born to this small group of slaves within their society, if Shemot is to be read at all as a, you know, kind of a wow, the Pharaoh and the Egyptians couldn't believe how many children they had, pru or vu, they did. And I think it's not just a matter of because they really loved each other more. I think that probably there's something in there that's said about ancient midwifery, that they were doing something right. Something. I don't know what it is. But that science helps us progress. With rain and wind, just to get to that one, and this is all getting towards liturgy that might now expand in order to give us more agency, because we recognize that even some of these old mysterious realms are understandable, at least, through science. With wind and rain, Rob and I were talking at Kiddush, and trying to go back to, somebody asked the question too about what is this connection between wind and rain, and there's a much better explanation for it than I gave about how these phenomena relate, and I'll let you share in a minute what you found. My sense is that there is still, and that's why liturgy contains this one line, there is still a sense that you go out and you basically have a forecast, and we understand enough about meteorology these days, and we understand thermodynamics, we understand some about physics, we understand some in some way how these relate to one another, and areas of high pressure and winds coming in different directions, but there's still some mystery to it. There really is. And it's mysterious how for a moment, you could be sitting in one block, having a cup of coffee, and all of a sudden, you know, there'll be a downpour, and so many gallons of water can be, you know, in those two blocks of an area, poured out of the sky. We're just down the street. The sun is still shining. The world is nobody needs an umbrella down the block. But you want to just say a little bit about what we were talking about?
So I was explaining that wind and rain are intimately related. That the ability of air to hold water is directly proportional to temperature. That is to say that if you decrease the temperature, the ability of air to hold water also decreases. So we can think of water as air as a big sponge. You cool it, it's like squeezing the sponge, and the water comes out. So there's three major modes of precipitation. It's orographic, cyclonic, and convectional. So orographic is it's when a body of air hits an obstruction that you typically have in the Pacific Northwest. Body of air comes over, it hits an obstruction in the mountains, it rises, it cools, and it rains. Here we have mostly cyclonic precipitation, which is one air mass comes in contact with a more dense air mass. The more dense air mass acts like a wedge. It brings up the moisture-laden air, it cools, and it rains. Convectional is what typically happens in the Midwest. Massive moisture-laden air comes over, say, a newly plowed field. It's darker, there's convection currents, the air rises, and it cools, and it's like squeezing the sponge, it cools, and the air rain comes out. And when, in each of these cases, when the air mass rises, you get convection currents, and the air is pulled in to fill the void, and that air that's pulled in, we call it rain.
Yeah. So great. So again, we start to understand these things more, and now the question with understanding them more becomes, what is our agency? If we understand where the bleeding comes from and where the potential infection is going to be, how much do we work to alleviate the potential problems all the way leading towards death? And we do. We say, Rapo Yurapei. If we begin to really understand thermodynamics and chart the winds, the way that bureaus of statistics can chart the wind patterns around the globe. And we can identify certain of the what we have as meteorological data and wind speeds and precipitation records and humidity in the atmosphere and barometric pressure. How much do we permit ourselves to say that line that, God, you have the ultimate control, but we are going to now start to, you know, even with the mountain that faces the that's on the other side of the peninsula, that generally is the landmass, that you know, what if we built and could build some kind of, you know, fin like we build on cars to pass through, or boats that pass through wind in a little bit of a different way? What if we start to redirect and start to swirl wind in a different way because we finally figure out the soup, the way to stir the soup in order to get the rain over the plains that make it nearly impossible, who knows, on the Mongolian steppe, the greatest area of green of grass and fluctuation in temperature, right? So who knows what will become of our being the ones to provide Parnassa then for the area of population in 2060 that will be beyond, we're already, what, at 6.6, 6.7 billion? Talking about massive amounts of people in the Far East who are going to need some food. Are we praying this because we see that God is the one in control? Or are we praying about recognizing God's control vis-a-vis the measurements we can start to understand, looking at God as the decipherable structures of the universe, so that scientific language becomes, in a certain sense, not only science and the language that describes, but this incredible tool that allows us to take some agency where science allows us to do that. There are other fields that help us understand the situation of human beings and all of this. And that's why we say it. And it's interesting that if that is what the prayer really gets us to start thinking about, then what's left? What's the one left that really gets us thinking? Because we have yet to really get reportage from the other side. What gets us really thinking is Tichiyat HaMeiti.
Yeah.
And what we mean when we say the ultimate resurrection of the dead, and the ultimate experience even of Olam Haba, of the next world. And if we immediately reject that as a concept within tradition, then just the invitation stands every time you stand up to say an Amidah, or you recognize there's a Siddur if prayer is not your thing, not your mitzvah, but it's there as the second blessing of what's called HaTefillah, the prayer. The second blessing we say in our Amidah is the recognition that God will one day give life to the dead. Now, you could say, I simply see it as symbolic language, and look at it like the early reformers do. When the prayer book reform in Europe starts happening in the 19th century, they change Michaei HaMeitim, who revives the dead and brings them to life, to Michaei HaKol. God, you give life to everything. And they mean it to be philosophically that you, when someone's feeling down, you bring life. When someone's feeling a little bit stepped on, you lift them up. But by the way, we have a blessing for that in the morning already. And that is the morning blessing to say. You put everyone's feet on the ground. You lift up the fallen. And even in Ashrei, that does not include the Nun, which I'm going to get tomorrow, by the way, to the Siddur class, so just a little bit of foreshadowing. Somech Noflim. You lift up the fallen. Michaei HaMeitim is not simply poetic, metaphorical language for the rabbis.
Isn't it really associated with the Messiah?
Well, that's the big question, too. What we learned in the Beit Midrash, I think it was 2 years ago, was it? Already 3 years ago. Perek HaChelek. We learned the last chapter of Sanhedrin. So, whether or not the resurrection has to coincide with the arrival of Messiah is an open question. Though there's a general association with the two, and that the world to come and the resurrection of the dead hinges on the arrival of Messiah, remember that Messiah as a figure is a figure that has a lot of different kinds of faces. If you look deeply into the beginnings of that theology within the last chapter of Sanhedrin, and then into Jewish thought in the Middle Ages. so that you can have everything from, yes, it's God's angel who announces the time has come, to it's a leper taking off and putting on bandages at the gate, and he's going to tell you that the time has arrived that God's going to really change up the world. And everything stays the same, except there are no more Jewish holidays. You don't have to change the dishes for Pesach. But Purim remains on the calendar.
You don't have to change the dishes?
Wait a minute. Wait, Bobby's
I'm
now
so
going to...
glad I came.
Bobby's now going to bring Messiah. No, no, that's not what I said, Bobby. It's not this world. It's only after the Messiah comes. So if you want to not change dishes, you have to start really pining for Messiah.
All right, well,
it's
an incentive.
It's an incentive. So the answer is yes. And so I think, though, the recognition of God's being in control of the next world, the resurrection of the dead, and that gets us thinking about what this life is really all about and what time we have and what we do with it and the systems we create to explain and the ways that we apply our wisdom and what we do with our hands and feet and how we share our resources and the parnassa and the tzedakah and all this that's wrapped up in this question, that, wow, this one really makes sense to me, is what I'm saying. This one makes sense. And to be open to that mystery of what happens beyond this world, what happens before this world and beyond this world, if time is somewhat of an illusion. And it's about the soul, or not even about the soul. It's about perpetuity of all matter. That is the great oneness. To go back to our Zoharic learning and our leanings, and the oneness that really is at the core of Shema Yisrael outlook. Hashem Echad, that all reality is Echad. So that's really, I think, core to it. Core to this tefillah, and core to the opening of this Masechta. Can you see these powers that God has, even with the agency you have, as deserving of your praise? And some of them deserve praise all the time, and some of them deserve praise in their own time, at the right time. And that's the system we devise to start encountering this thought. Let's look at this chapter. And I have one blessing here, just so that we could take this diversion. When do we start really saying it's about us and what we make of our lives and the agency we need, quote-unquote, month to month? And when God passed the keys along to Elijah, as we saw the Tosfot say, when did that happen, and how amazing that was back in his time, and what a miracle it seemed like for the Tanakh period, though we've talked about now how we understand in our time a little bit more through the lens of science, especially. Take a look at this. I put the first thing I put on this supplement is the blessing for when we announce the new month. Because Parnassa got me thinking when they suggested that we have to kind of leave to God's power or trust that God has in God's power, the notion of our making a living. We say the word Parnassa within this blessing. And we recite this before every Rosh Chodesh. You know, on a practical level, when the new month was starting, we announced this because they didn't have printed calendars, right? You needed to know when Rosh Chodesh was coming. You needed to know the timing for holidays up and coming. You had a public announcement of the new month. And you already had in Masechet Brachot, in the Gemara, an announcement that times there are changing. You know, and people, for whatever they thought about the moon going out of sight and then coming back into sight, they understood that these cycles could be meaningful by way of the production of a rhythm for life. Yihi ratzon milfanecha, adonai Eloheinu ve'levoteinu, may it be your will, God, shetechadesh aleinu et achodesh haba, may you renew the month, letova v'livracha, for goodness and for blessing, Batitein lanu chayim arukim, give us long life, grant us long life. Chayim shel shalom, a life of peace. Chayim shel tova, a life of goodness. Chayim shel bracha, a life of blessing. Chayim shel parnasa, there's our word, good living, what to sustain us. Chayim shel chilutz atamot, may we have strength of our bones, vitality. Chayim shel yesh behem yirat shamayim v'yirat chet, we should have an awe of heaven and a fear of sin, apprehension about sinning. Chayim she'ein behem busha uchlima, don't let us be shamed or reproached. Chayim shel osher v'chavod, a rich and abundant life, an honored existence. Chayim shetehevanu, life that we have within it, ahavat Torah, a love and loyalty to the Torah. Yirat Shemayim is mentioned again, an awe of heaven. Chayim sheyimalu mishalot libeinu l'tova, a life that will lead to our heart's desires being fulfilled. Amen, Selah. Who's responsible for that life? Are we saying through this prayer as well that the keys are in your hand, God, when we make this blessing for a new moon? Or are we reminding ourselves of the values that we have to sustain, a la the notion that Jay brought forward about don't feel such hubris that it was all in your hands to have earned that keep, because God was really behind it to begin with. Right? Liturgically, I would say that the rabbis were interested in the latter, so that it is a Musser approach of sorts, without it being the Musser movement yet from the 19th century. It is a put your perspective in check and take your agency seriously and go out into the world and fill the world with all of this. But there is some part of this I could ask you to go through and say, what's really not in your control? Like Dale said, ultimately, not every aspect of health is in our control. Right? Ultimately, weather's not in our total control. Ultimately, childbirth is not ultimately in our control, though we're getting better, though we can be effective with it. So what part of this is our part? What part of this is God's part? And how many percent, if I had moving meters, right? And for each one of these, I could kind of start to think, when I pray, the Gemara, I think, has these intentions behind it, by the way. That's why I'm bringing it here, to say, think about your agency and think about what God has control over. Is there one or another that stands out as being, you know, either totally in God's control or totally in our control or surprising on the list that we would even...
Piety, you know, people can dedicate themselves to the Torah and for piety, so the kind of degree of observance is under your control.
Yeah. Right?
Long life is not.
No.
It seems to me.
A lot of things.
Right, that one seems to be, you know, hey, look, we all want it, and we want it for each other.
Well, I mean,
yeah, you're right.
Maybe this is a statistical thing. It'd be absolute chaos if God granted everyone's wish, right? We couldn't, I mean, there's so many conflict. But if we all pray for the same thing, then it's easier for God to do it. I mean, no, otherwise... The world would be chaos if God granted everyone's wish. There's too many conflicts.
Well, the reason of creation of God was because everyone was poor. And we wanted somebody to support us, or somebody that we will pray to feel better.
Well, that's from your very humanocentric position. That's from your very humanocentric position.
Yeah, I think the whole creation of God in our human concept is that...
That is, Heschel would say to you, that's an afterthought. That's not a prime thought. Kaplan would agree with you that it's the power that made for salvation among human beings.
I wonder why we don't have it every day, this prayer.
Every month.
I
agree. I think this is one of the most beautiful prayers we say all together.
Yeah,
it's
beautiful.
But there are in the morning service, there are pieces.
But there's not this.
It's not all pieces.
And it's exactly why I said about daily prayer, do we say enough what we should remind ourselves about? What I like to do in the morning is get to prayer early enough or at home, say the prayers before page 10, is what I call them. Because they're the ones that say, these are the things without measure. Attending to the needs of the bride and groom, funerals and simchas, and studying in the Beit Midrash, and trying to do enough tzedakah in the world every morning. You know, sometimes you don't get there. Sometimes you don't get there. You just start with the morning blessings, because somehow, you know, we ran over those quickly. This we say once a month. Maybe it would be too much to remind ourselves every day. There were some rebbes, you'll see in their siddurim, and I'll get to you in a second, Dale, who had and wrote their own private tefillah before the tefillah, their private prayer before the prayer, and daily incorporated most, if not all, of this list. Beautiful prayers. And some siddurim collect all now five or six of the most popular ones. And as I've said to the siddur class, that siddur as a genre of literature has expanded so much within the last two decades. Because I think of a need that our Gemara philosophically is purporting. And that is, there's got to be a recognition of God's power in the world, but there's also a deeper recognition in our time, even among the most fundamentalist of Jewish communities, the agency we have as human beings. Dale, and then Ari.
So, in this question of what do we have agency over and what does God have agency over, I've always read this as asking God for help with those things over which I have agency.
Mm.
It's all in His hands. He can help me, or He could test me.
Mm. Nice. That's a wonderfully personal theology. And if you do trust that God wants to help, another level of the faith that could go along with that. Right?
Right.
All right.
To the question, why do we say this every day? Because for a new month, it's like a revival, a renewal. So this prayer is like a renewal of our original thoughts. So I think that's why it probably was done per month, rather than every day, which will become too normal.
Right, and in liturgical studies, definitely there's this notion that prayer of the everyday becomes entirely rote. The rabbis already in Pirkei Avot said, "Al tase tzilat hakeva," don't become so rote with words. You know, have different kavanah intentionality each day. Some of the prayers rotate in and some of them rotate out for the purpose of renewing. I think you're on to a certain experience of liturgy. Some people really like to repeat the most meaningful and could repeat daily. Some people like that insertion.
Well, the moon is also renewed. Light is renewed. You get
right.
to know light, and then before this, then it grows again. So you need this at a point when you really don't have the moon.
That's very true, that it's connected to that natural darkness and then the coming light again.
It helps you because you may get frightened by the darkness.
Right. Good. I included the story of Malachim Aleph, chapter 17 and 18, just to point out that this is the locus of Eliyahu's, Elijah the prophet's, having the keys of rain, of, in a certain way, Tichyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, in the rabbi's way and the Tanakh's way of understanding it, and the notion of childbirth, if you will, because it's to this widow that Eliyahu is entrusted in her care, and she has a child whom he had promised, and then he's about to die, and he revives that child almost in an ancient measure of CPR, most likely, and you have him saying to the king, who's a wicked king, I'm going to withhold the rain and the dew. And by chapter 18, you have, and chapter 18 is on the back of the packet, it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go show thyself unto Ahab, and I'll send rain upon the land. And Elijah went to show himself unto Ahab, and the famine was sore in Samaria, in Shomron, and Ahab called Ovadia, who was over the household. Now Avadya feared the Lord greatly, for it was so when Izebel had cut off the prophets from the Lord, and since they had come back in a certain way, Eliyahu met him, verse 7, and he knew him and fell on his face and said, "Is it thou, my lord Eliyahu?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go tell the Lord, behold, Eliyahu's here." And he said to them, "Wherein have I sinned that you would slay, deliver the servant into the hand of Ahab, slay me?" And there's this workout, and this is the time that he's going to overcome the prophets of Baal, which Bobby made reference to the other, I think it was 2 weeks ago or last week. And that is, what happens is that Elijah starts to control, in a certain sense, God's powers and need God to deliver fire and water. And so what is that other symbol that's within this passage of the Tanakh? When Elijah is taking on these prophets of Baal, this idolatrous god, he calls upon God. God sends water to even wet the sacrifices that Elijah is going to make in God's name. And the fire comes and consumes everything, even though they're soaking wet. And what's the symbol of fire even? Which I might have thought is in God's hands as well, except that we know now it's in our hands, and over the last at least however long we have fire, some different dates for how old the age of fire really is. Whether it's, you know, within 10,000 years or it's 8,000 years, the actual productive use. You know, we don't have furnaces that can really heat the kind of sand we need for glass, silicon, up, you know, back through, let's say, 4,500 years ago. If then, we might even say that it's 3,500 years ago if it's glass that's going to last, and it's the Turkish region and the Middle Ages. So that fire becomes something we master. The reason fire comes out of heaven is because ultimately it is, quote-unquote, in God's control. And that God gave us fire in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle. God gave us fire to use within the sanctuary. We shouldn't lose, you know, it shouldn't be lost on us that part of the control of fire on the altar is as important as the bringing of the animals themselves, or the meal offerings, or what have you. It's that control of fire that also is about our agency and what and how we manage that element within creation. Elijah is able to call and control it. Again, not forever. Elijah has a certain amount of that agency in these passages. Part of Tanakh is talking about this same philosophical question. How much does God entrust these keys to humanity below, to the prophets below? How much can we ask for it and change God's thinking in terms of keeping them in heaven? Who gets to really make those moves with these powers that be? And in our time, what are we going to say in terms of our prayers that continues to grant space to recognize the mystery, to recognize the power of God, and that also really spurs us on to use our agency properly? That's where we are so far by 2b2. Lot to say on one daf of Gemara. Okay, we're going to get to another section now on 2b2 on the right-hand side. Go back to the Gemara. And we're going to now start to go back to some of how we learn about when we mention rain and why we're mentioning the powers of rain and what's the linkage here. Before, we got into a little bit of an inkling that the temple and sacrifices would be connected to our discussion, because anytime you start talking about prayer, you're going to probably start talking about the history of the temple. And this is where we're going to get a little bit of that in our Gemara. The Gemara quotes one of the opinions recorded in the Braita and gives its source now. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira Omer, Basheni b'chag hu mazkir. If we're going to go back to the Mishnah and say that there's a position that on the second day of the Yontif we should mention the powers of rain, beginning the second day of the festival of Sukkot, my Talmud the Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira. Why would Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira teach that? That's not one of the original Mishnaic rabbis, by the way. Recall that the original pair who were arguing in the Mishnah were Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Eliezer. Okay, so that was a Braita. This is now a separate learning from the Tannaitic age, but not the original Mishnaic rabbis. The Tanya, we taught in a Braita, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira Omer, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira says, Ne'amar b'sheni, say it in connection on the second day because of the Tamid offering, because of the offering. And it says, V'niskehem. And with that offering, we have libations. Instead of just saying niska, which it could have said, because all sacrifices require wine pouring libations in the temple, we have niskehem, which means that there must be more than just one libation, the regular libation of wine. We must have another one. And what's that other one?
Water.
Water. And it's only during the festival of Sukkot that you have water libations. And it never says that you have water libations anywhere in the Torah. It only will say that in our Gemara. In other words, in the Talmud. A mem was added, v'niskehem, instead of v'niska, this plural form was added to teach you that there was a wine libation and a water libation. V'nemar b'shishi, and in connection with the Tamid offering of the sixth day of Sukkot, it said, u'nisacheha, and its libations instead of niska, and that yud was added for exegetical purposes. So I take the mem of niskehem, and I take the yud of the sixth day, and I have mem yud. What do I need?
Mem.
Another mem. V'nem ar v'shvi'i, and it's said on the seventh day, k'mishpatam, not k'mishpat, according to their rulings, and therefore I get an extra mem, and hare, mem yud mem, thus the letters that are extra in the Torah that I can learn the word that I need to learn, in order to say there's a mayim in addition to a yayin libation, a water in addition to a wine libation, hare kan mayim. Behold, I have water. And so the extra libation that I have on the holiday of Sukkot, all 7 days in the tradition, is a water libation in addition to a wine libation. Mikan remez l'nisuch hamayim min haTorah. And this is the way we learn from Torah verses the libation of water that we know is the temple tradition on Sukkot. Umayshna b'sheni dinakat, but why did Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira designate the second day of Sukkot as the beginning for the mention of powers of rain? That just tells me what? That I have water libations on Sukkot in addition to wine libations. Why does he tell me I have to start mentioning Mashiv Ruach and Merida Gashim on the second day? The powers of rain on the second day of the festival. Dechi remize lahu bikra, when scripture alludes to the water libations, v'sheini hu derimize. The first part of the allusion is found in connection with the second day of Sukkot. So if it's first found in the second day of Sukkot, that's obviously how Rabbi ben Beteira ultimately concludes. Hilkach b'sheini midekarinan. Therefore, according to Rabbi ben Beteira, we begin to mention the powers of rain on the second day. The Gemara cites a Braita, which records the source for now another opinion. So what do I do so far? I prove within the corpus of rabbinic literature from these three verses right now that the temple practice I know about on Sukkot is actually a deraita. Well, it's not really deraita, but it's from the Torah. Because at that point, what are we learning about? The history of the temple and the way that Sukkot was practiced in the temple. What we just learned was that instead of just doing wine libations, they also did water libations. And you had a unique way of adding wine and water to the altar in the temple service. And you had vessels for such things. And you had mentions of this in the Mishnah in Sukkot, so that if we were studying all of Mishnah Sukkah, which is about the holiday of Sukkot, we would see how libations were done. And over here in Tani, we just prove through these verses that we understand that it is a Torah commandment by finding the extra mem, the extra yud, and the extra mem, the word mayim. Ah, but when I do that now, and when they did it on the altar for the holiday of Sukkot, with all the discussion I already had on the full page of Gemara that we had learned, we now understand why there's this water libation. Because having water involved in the ceremonials is the time that we truly remind ourselves that we are fully dependent on God's judging us favorably and judging the world favorably for rain, and using that power, which is not really ours, for the benefit of us and all 70 nations of the world. Because remember, Sukkot has so many sacrifices that we have sacrifices on our own behalf, and we have sacrifices on behalf of the nations of the world, which we called 70 nations of the world as the figure we use. What is the difference between a wine libation and a water libation as a symbolic item for sacrifice? Water, if I need to prepare it to become a sacrifice, do I really need to do anything to it? I need to do nothing but bring it plainly as water. Like I need to present myself plainly before God.
The wine would cut with water, though.
In this case, whether you cut it with water is not the issue. The fact that you go through the process of making wine, of understanding ancient wine production, of producing it, of taking the grape, making something of it, the same way we took wheat, and we made something of it, we bring the food. So on, sometimes we bring the grains of wheat, right? It says in the pure form, God, we so appreciate you just make the wheat or the barley grow like this. But sometimes what do? We bake loaves. So these are symbolic, like the grains we wave and the loaves we make. This is the time. Sukkot is the only week that we have the water and the wine. And then the water becomes the symbol for plain coming, God's resources in their purest form, and wine, what we produce, what we mix, what we need to add water to or not. We don't know exactly if they've added the water to the wine because you did that for drinking. But you didn't necessarily have to do that in the temple. And it's now the answer for the Jewish mindset of knowing from the Talmud. So if the world of Christendom took wine to be about blood, did we ever have wine as blood? No, we had blood on the altar as blood. But wine was the symbol of the human being and the way the human being makes of God's gifts that which is needed to make the human heart glad and sanctify and be sanctified and bring that level of agency into the picture, which stands in contrast to the water.
Now, what about the concept that we weren't going to pray too early because it could be that that prayer immediately encourages God to send rain and we don't want it on the second day of Sukkot? So how does
So I would say about that one, by the way, that, and we're going to see some of these stories come up, so you're foreshadowing some Agadita, some stories that we're going to read.
That was the principle of choosing a day that pilgrims can get back, and so we don't want it to be on top of ours.
We are being thankful in the temple and making these libations so that it's gratitude and recognition of the gifts, as opposed to praying for it with these offerings. We're not offering them to say,
so
please send it.
The second day of Sukkot is...
That's Rabbi Ben Bateira's limud, but that's not when we actually started.
Okay.
That we're in a brisa now that suggested that day, but that's not the day we started, A. And B, we're not really praying for it with the libation. We're recognizing God's power and giving gratitude.
Ben Bateira did say something about...
Right, Ben Bateira said that, but that's just a brisa and it's not the accepted halacha.
Okay.
It's where we stand in the Gemara with his suggestion. But more to the point is the symbolism that comes up about the in terms of the conversation and his limud. Yeah? So we have this now understanding of wine and water and that these libations are happening. Rabbi Akiva has a different take. When the scripture alludes to the water libations, b'sheni dehu remize, hilkach b'sheni midekirinan, And then we're going to go to Rabbi Akiva, second column on 2b3. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Bashishi Bechag Hu Mazkir. How about on the sixth day we should really say who gave the powers a range? And Amar Bashishi, it said in connection with the sixth day, Unisakreha, plural of libations instead of Veniska, Bashani Nisuchin Hakatuv Medaber. The Nisuch HaMayim, the pouring of water, the great water festival that's talked about in the Mishnah on Sukkos. That's what goes on the second day. But then B'Teira, we should say it on the sixth day. That Nisuch HaMayim is a great, great pouring out of waters that's prepared for the festival of Sukkot, which creates all kinds of celebration in the outer court, which is really called the Ezrat Nashim, in the women's area of the temple, and created all kinds of fun. One year I shared a drush about that time period. You have jugglers and fire-eating sages and wonderful celebrations in the courtyard of the temple for the pouring out of the water. Again, the notion of gratitude for and thanks for and recognition of the gift, but not necessarily the prayer for it. But Rabbi Akiva is going with the sixth day, and he says, maybe we're just talking about wine, though, and the Gemara is going to go back and forth. He's basically asking the question, are we really talking about water? And then the last little part of that, Savarla ka Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, he agrees with Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, De'ama Remize Maya, who said that water is alluded to by the addition of these letters, Mem, Yud, and Mem. So what we're really talking about is everybody agrees there is water and not wine. Go to 3A1 with me. We'll start into a new daf. But if Rabbi Akiva agrees with Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, in other words, that Mayim was mentioned in Torah, so does he have to agree with him about everything and say it's the second day and not the sixth day? Neima Kavate, let him say, as Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira does, that we begin the powers of the rain on the second day. The Gemara is going to answer, Kasava Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva reasons as follows, Ki Kativ Nisuch Yeteira, when Scripture makes reference to an extra libation, Bashishi Hu Dechativ, the reference is made in connection with the sixth day of Sukkot, and we leave it kind of there. So far, that's a discussion internally of having different traditions of when you might start to say it, even though our Mishnah was talking about the beginning of the Chag and the last day of the Chag, to tell you that all this is in liturgical flux. And the when, me'ematai, as a functional question, back to the beginning of the Mishnah, is important. And it's not just the why, which is what I started with. In other words, why ask the when if we don't even know the why? Now that we've got the why on the table, let's go back to the when. Let's share that there were lots of opinions about the when, and let's understand that each of them have their reasons, and in the argumentation about the reasons why we might say it any given day, what did we also tease out? That in fact water libations during Sukkot, which we know is a temple practice, was really a Torah commandment, even though the Torah didn't say it explicitly. Because water is such a powerful symbol. Rain is such a powerful key on God's ring. And I have to celebrate it. And sometimes in Jewish history, temple culture included, we had to really learn from the Torah in our what is called hermeneutical way, teasing out letters from the verses of Torah, understanding how to read them through Chazal's eyes now, that we can understand that sometimes they had to be the ritual, creative ritual geniuses they wanted to be. They were for Am Yisrael in establishing practices that become what? Deoraita. That they become connected to the Torah. Part of what we're getting at the outset of our Gemara is the rabbinic approach to creativity within bounds, creativity within boundaries. I can heksher, say that this water libation in the temple is kosher, because I have verses that hint at it. And you see how these sages, who were arguing about different days, teased it out of the verses? Ah, I do understand that it is truly Torah rooted when it comes to what I do to recognize God's power over waters, not only including my tefillah and the line I insert, Mashiva Ruach Umarit Hagashem, God, you make the wind blow and the rain fall, but what our ancestors did in the temple too was kosher from Torah, the way they did it in their time when we had the temple standing, and now I'll do it in my time, the way you're telling us to in the Mishnah Rabbis. Links it in a very deep way to a continuity factor of Sadducean and Pharisaic Judaism, Kohenic, temple ritual-based to prayer-based Judaism. And I get the line of history starting in that positive way to say, we are doing what our ancestors were doing. We are recognizing the powers of God in terms of bringing rain and wind, just like our ancestors in the temple recognized the powers of God when they made water libations in addition to the wine that was called for explicitly in the Torah. And that's really where we stand as we push forward in the Gemara. Listen to you. My pleasure. Good to learn together.